My name is Michael Stollard, and my book is Connection Culture, The Competitive Advantage of Shared Identity, Empathy, and Understanding at Work. And you can learn more about my work at my blog, michaelleestollard.com, or our company's website, connectionculture.com.
Michael, why an update of Connection Culture?
There's been so much research that's come out that really gives us greater insights into the importance of connection, that connection is a superpower that makes us smarter, happier, and more productive, and just the perils of disconnection. Julian Holt Lunstad, an academic researcher at Brigham Young, consolidated, it's called a meta-analysis, research of existing studies, and she found that people who were more connected had a 50% reduced risk of early death, and those who were disconnected, were lonely, socially isolated, or living alone, had a risk of death that was equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So that's just one piece of research that's come out. And the other thing about the book is that we wanted to make it much more diverse. So we've added a lot of examples of women and people of color who are in leadership positions who cultivated cultures of connection. And there's so many great examples. We lead the book with the story of Lin-Manuel Miranda and the team that developed Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful story, going back to his childhood and just having this loving family and community that he lived in, and his ability to attune to other people's emotions. It's one of the most inspiring stories I've read in the last year, and we wanted to share that with readers. I just think they'll really be encouraged by Lin, who is, I would call him a super connector.
He couldn't do it alone, and I think his story shows that.
Absolutely, and I think another story that comes out of that story is about Tom Kail. They're very close friends and collaborators, and there are others in that core group as well. And Tom Kail calls their culture a culture of harmony. And he's very intentional about getting to know the actors, connecting with them, and he values kindness and refuses to work with people who are not kind. So there's so many great nuggets of wisdom in this story from Lin and Tommy Kail and others. I know people are going to love it.
You say that we are hardwired to connect, and I've been talking to you for a number of years, and that's always stayed with me. We are hardwired to connect, but yet we don't, especially at work.
Well, it's tasks have crowded out relationships in the workplace, and I think I spent a lot of my early years in technology and on Wall Street, and you were looked at as a slacker if you took lunch away from your desk. It was really devalued, but what we're finding out through just this surge of neuroscience research is that, as I said earlier, connection is a superpower that makes us smarter, happier, and more productive. And it makes us more resilient to cope with stress. And as we all know, stress is a big issue these days. It was going up before the pandemic, and it's risen higher since. So a lot of people are struggling because stress is higher. We've had this loneliness epidemic. Last research showed that 61% of adults tested out as lonely. And then social isolation from the pandemic is making matters worse. And of course, that's boosting anxiety, depression, addiction, even suicide, Pat. So one of the reasons we wrote the book originally is we wanted to help people live better emotional and physical lives from an emotional and physical health standpoint. And that's part of what the book does, is helps them in those areas to cope with high stress.
A great thing about connection culture is that it shows that many people are getting it right. Even though we have an epidemic of loneliness, as you mentioned, some people are getting it right. And getting into some of their stories was really helpful. I can remember the very first time we spoke, which was how many years ago? A decade ago, maybe? Or
probably
7 years ago? It's been a while. The very first time we spoke, you told me about Nick the doorman at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I think he epitomizes how you're part of an organization and how you can make a real difference.
Well, Nick Medley, absolutely. My wife, Katie, as you know, was diagnosed. Katie is a 3-time cancer survivor, and she had been diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer. And Pat, I was on our first visit to Sloan Kettering, as we were walking toward the entrance, I was expecting to go into a culture of death and dying. But then Nick reached out, and in a town where very few of us make eye contact, we're all so busy. You know, Nick locks his eyes on Katie and smiles and greets her like a returning friend. And it was always that way with Nick, every time we went to Sloan Kettering. But we found most other people that we interacted with there as well, the security people, the administrative people, Katie's oncologist, Dr. Marty Hensley, Katie's oncologist for ovarian cancer. And it just really caught my attention. And we know from medical research that patients who feel connected fare better on average than those who are trying to go through a serious illness alone.
There are many other stories in which people show how they can individually make a difference. What about Alan Mulally at Ford when he was introduced his first day on the job as CEO when he was asked what he drove?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Alan. I received an email from him last week saying that he bought his copy in advance. He can't wait to read it.
Nice.
That was exciting. We've stayed in touch. You know, Alan came into Ford Motor Company at a time it was headed toward bankruptcy. It was losing billions of dollars a year. And of course, he came from Boeing, and someone asked him when he was introduced what kind of car he drives. And his response was, a Lexus, the finest car in the world. And I'm sure you could have heard a pin drop in that room, Pat. But it showed that Alan's a straight shooter. He's going to say what's on his mind. You know, he's very tactful and diplomatic and sensitive to people. In fact, one of the things he forbid at Ford was people who used humor at the expense of others.
Oh.
But he really, you see everything in terms of vision, value, voice, and cultivating a connection culture. And Alan told me that connection culture helps explain why he's been so successful in his career and saved the Ford Motor Company, which we lay out in the profile of his story.
Another inspiring example was the kneaded bread in Port Chester.
Yes, Fernando. Everybody knows Fernando. And the kneaded bread is a small store started by a Culinary Institute of America trained chef. It's immensely popular in our area. But I would say its competitive advantage is its manager, an immigrant from Mexico, Fernando Bastida. He knows literally, he just seems to know everyone. And he's a magnet. Whenever you see Fernando, he's super friendly and knows family members and what's going on in your life. And he's just a magnet for people there. And of course, the quality of the breads that are made there make it popular as well. But that connection makes a difference from a competitive standpoint. And one of the points we make in the book, Pat, is that organizations that have higher human connection, they perform better than those who don't. But also from an individual standpoint, it protects our health, as I mentioned earlier, but it also gives you a competitive advantage. If you're an employee working in a culture that's disconnecting, you're not going to give your best performance, and you run the risk that your employer is going to view you as not a high potential employee. And so it can really taint your career and limit your progress if you're working in a culture that's not bringing out your best.
What if you aren't at the top? How can you affect change? You look around and you think, boy, this is a cold environment I'm working in. What can you do to change it?
Well, I often get this question. It usually sounds like, don't you have to be at the top of the organization to change culture? But
right.
What we have found, and we've worked with a mix of organizations. We've worked with very small medical system startups. We've worked with Costco, which is huge. What we found that every organization is made up of subcultures, and they're very different. Some are very connecting, and people are very inspired and performing at their very best. And then you may walk down the hall 100 yards and find a culture that's just sucking the life out of people. So the good news in that is that you can affect your local culture. You don't have to start ideal, of course. One of the stories we have in the book is as CNO Admiral Vern Clark, who was the chief of the Navy and the impact he had on the Navy's culture. But you don't have to be in that position. It's you influence your local culture, and that's what has the biggest impact on you.
Structurally, I was impressed. A station I worked for a while ago, the sales department and the newsroom were on the same floor. They were almost connected. So you could interact with the sales associates on a daily basis. You became friendly with them. You started talking about the news that you were covering. But then they moved the sales department to another floor. And it really affected the culture of the workplace to such a degree, it was almost like you were working at two different organizations. What about that?
There are issues of just physical proximity. So, for example, more organizations have designed their physical environment to boost connection. Mm-hmm. Now with the pandemic, it's thrown things. We're trying to figure that out. Most people are working remotely. So that's to be determined, I think, how things are going to play out as we cope with the pandemic. But certainly those physical things make a difference. So I think of the Mayo Clinic. One of the profiles we have in the book is of the Mayo Clinic. One of the things they've done is they've brought back spaces for physicians to congregate just to promote collegiality and connection. And they've also, they can sign up for a program called Compass, where they get a stipend that covers their lunch. You know, they can meet with a group of colleagues twice a month, and the Mayo Clinic picks up the tab. And the Mayo Clinic gives them a list of subjects to consider discussion. And I find a lot of physicians are lonely and struggle with stress, addiction, burnout, and suicide. And so the Mayo Clinic, who's done a great deal of research on this for years, has found that having their physicians get together and build these support groups really makes a difference in reducing their stress levels, improving their performance, and reducing physician burnout, which is a big issue in our country.
What specific things can you do to improve the culture around you if you really have a desire to do that?
Well, think of Nick the doorman, Nick Medley,
yes.
And he has a huge impact on Sloan Kettering. He's probably the most known person at Sloan Kettering,
yeah.
Quite honestly.
Yes.
Nick, he's out there connecting people, connecting physicians and caregivers with people who work at Sloan Kettering. And we can all do that. We can take the time to get to know our colleagues. In fact, research shows, Pat, that as we get to know more about the personal lives of colleagues, it increases helping behaviors and reduces what's called social undermining. So there are benefits to getting to know people's lives outside of work. And for a supervisor, we also want to be open about sharing our lives outside of work. It goes both ways. So simple things like that. And then in the book, we also talk about more elaborate things. One practice we've identified is called knowledge flow sessions, where leaders take issues they're grappling with in front of a group and say, they put their cards on the table and share, here's what I'm thinking. And then they ask, what's right, what's wrong, what's missing from my thinking? And just be quiet and listen and learn from the people who are present. That additional knowledge they gain helps them make better decisions, but it also makes the rest of the people feel more connected because they feel valued and they have a voice in decisions. It doesn't mean they have a vote, but they have a voice, and that will improve the quality of decisions in the organization and the performance because people feel more connected.
I would think also, since we are working virtually, having maybe a Zoom coffee date online with somebody in your department, something like that could help, whether you're with a colleague or your management reaching out to one of your people.
Yes, absolutely. Just a lot of people are not happy with Zoom. And there is some research that shows for some introverts that just the video calls to many of them can be anxiety producing. So, you know, I think it's important to be sensitive and let people choose what they want. Is it going to be a Zoom call or just a regular audio conversation via telephone? But making sure we're reaching out to people and connecting with them, our colleagues or the people we're responsible for leading, is really important. And that can be through telephone call, through Zoom meeting, you know, just having coffee together and catching up what's going on in your life and your work, and texting, writing personal notes. I do a lot of that. I'm a big believer in writing cards to people. So there are a lot of ways to stay connected, and you just want to make sure that you're intentional about it, or the tasks can squeeze it out of our mind and then it doesn't happen, and that has an effect on us. And also, I want to just bring up the point. I was talking to a neuroscientist at the National Institutes of Health a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying he just feels more tired these days. And he started thinking about it and realized that, well, our brain is perceiving that the environment's changed. We're not around people as much. It perceives that as a threat. And so we're processing more in the part of our brain that uses more energy because it's more hypervigilant, just sensing that something is amiss. Yeah. In our environment after being around so many people for all these years. And so it's natural that we are going to be more tired, and we have to be more intentional about connecting with people. That has two impacts. And number one, it engages the cortex of the brain where we make rational decisions. So it will help us make better decisions, and it calms our nerves so that we feel better.
Have you found, Michael, that people seem to be more emotional, or maybe they're more in touch with their emotions?
Well, I haven't seen any research on it. I'll just share that.
I do think
people are longing to connect. And so it's, you know, our body is wired for connection. And so it's baked into our nervous system. And so it will send us signals that will compel us to try to connect with other people. So I would not be surprised if there's going to be more of that. People are going to be looking for, you know, they're going to be opening up a little more and wanting to share in ways that bring connection. And when you think about how connection happens, one way to think about it is spending more time with people and also opening up more over time, and that builds a deeper connection.
I was especially interested in your chapter, Whom Will You Choose to Become? And I think that's at a crux of making connections, isn't it?
It is. It's, you know, one of the first steps we recommend for leaders and organizations is developing a connection mindset. Number one, understanding that connection is important. It's a superpower. We need it to flourish. We won't flourish without that in life. And disconnection can sabotage our life and our performance at work. So once we know that, then we have a choice to make. Are we going to become intentional about connecting, or are we going to ignore it? And we drift naturally away from connection and toward task in our culture in the U.S. And so it's important to be intentional about it or it won't happen. And the research shows it has a profound impact on our health, our happiness, and our performance.
That was well said. Anything else you want to add?
I think you covered it well. I think that's a real strength of the book. It provides a simple, memorable, and actionable framework to help people understand how to cultivate a culture that's going to bring out the best in them and the people they care about and who they're responsible for leading. And it's an inspiring and optimistic book at a time when I think we need that.
Boy, I'll say. I like your comment about you have to be intentional about it. I mean, it's great to hear the stories and to think about it a little bit, but if you're not intentionally going out and making a connection in your own way, then you have to take that next step.
I have some things scheduled in my calendar just on a regular basis.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I meet with a group of friends every Saturday morning from like 9 till at least 11:30. You know, we've been doing this for years. I don't even know. And now we're doing it on Zoom, Pat. So I think it's a guys group. Our oldest guy is in his 80s. Our youngest guy is in his 20s.
Wow.
Isn't that great? So it's a very diverse group in many ways, you know, both age-wise and racial backgrounds. And the guys who moved away, we have one guy who calls in at 6 a.m. in the morning from Seattle.
Wow.
And another guy who lived in New York and moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and he calls in from St. Paul. So those guys have stayed a part of the group. And I love that. You know, we're great friends, and that makes a big difference in my life.
That's great.